it would turn out to be another illusion, and that the respite of sand and swells would flee farther away with every step they took.
No,
he nodded.
That's all right. We'll try to get to them before it gets too hot. We might be able to get some dew off their branches.
Dew. Water. Even just a lick. Just a taste. Never again would she snub a single muddy gulp. She started again, her legs screaming with the first few steps, until they began to numb again to the endless walking. Then, her eye snagged on something big and white, and she froze. Thorn crashed into her, and Cress would have collapsed if he hadn't wrapped his arms around her shoulders, steadying her.
What's wrong?
There's an animal, she whispered, afraid to startle the creature that stood at the top of the dune. It had already seen them and was staring serenely at Cress. She tried to place it with what she knew of earth and wildlife. A goat of some sort? A gazelle? It had slender white legs atop enormous hooves and a rounded belly that showed the edges of ribs. Its calm face was tan, with swaths of black and white, like a mask around its eyes. Two towering spiral horns twisted up from its head, doubling its height. It was the first earthen animal she had ever seen, and it was beautiful and regal and mysterious, watching her with dark, unblinking eyes. For a moment, she imagined that she could speak to it with her mind, ask it to lead them to safety. It would recognize the goodness inside her and take pity like an ancient animal goddess sent to guide her to her destiny.
An animal?
Thorn said, and she realized he'd been waiting for her to further explain what she was seeing. It has long legs and horns and it's beautiful.
Oh, good. We're back to this again.
She could hear the smile in his tone, but she dared not take her gaze from the creature, lest it dissolve into the air like a phantom.
Could mean there's a water source nearby, Thorn mused. We should keep going.
Cress took a tentative step forward. She felt the slip of sand more keenly than she had before, and recognized just how clumsy she and Thorn were, stumbling and scrambling over the dunes, while this creature stood so elegant and calm. The creature tilted its head, not moving as Cress inched closer. She didn't realize she was holding her breath until the beast's eyelids flickered, and it turned its head towards something on the other side of the dune. The crack of a gunshot rang out across the desert. Chapter 24. The creature balked and tumbled down the dune, blood dripping from the wound in its side. Cress cried out and fell backward. Thorn pulled her down into the sand. Cress, are you all right? She was shaking, watching as the animal fell and rolled the rest of the way, gathering clumps of sand on its hide. She wanted to scream, but any noise was paralyzed inside her, and she could think of nothing but that the animal had wanted to say something to her, and now the world was tilting and fading, and she was going to be sick, and there was blood in the sand, and she didn't know what happened, and Cress! Cress! Thorn's hands were on her, searching, and she realized dully that he thought she had been shot. She grabbed his wrists, holding them tight and trying to convey the truth through her grip when words wouldn't come to her.
I'm all...
She paused. They both heard it, panting, along with the slip and scramble of footsteps. Cress cowered, pressing into Thorn's embrace as terror washed over her. A man appeared at the top of the dune, carrying a shotgun. He saw the animal first, dying or dead, but then spotted Cress and Thorn from the corner of his eye. He yelped, barely keeping his balance, and gaped at them. His eyebrows disappeared beneath a gauzy headdress. His brown eyes and the bridge of his nose were all she could see of his face. The rest of him, covered in a robe that draped nearly to his ankles, protected him from the harsh desert elements. Beneath the robe peeked a pair of denim pants and boots that had long been sun-bleached and caked with sand. He finished his own inspection of Cress and Thorn and lowered the gun. He began to speak, and for a moment, Cress thought that the sun and exhaustion had driven her mad after all. She didn't understand a word he said. Thorne's grip tightened on her arms. For a moment, the man stared at them in silence. Then he shifted, his eyebrows lowering and revealing flecks of gray in them.
"Universal, then,"
he said, in a thick accent that still made it a struggle to capture the words. He scanned their ragged clothes and sheets.
"You are not from here."
"Yes, sir," said Thorne, his voice rusty. "We need help. My wife and I were attacked and robbed 2 days ago. We have no more water. Please, can you help us?"
The man squinted.
"Your eyes."
Thorne's lips puckered. They'd been trying to hide his new disability, but his eyes still looked unfocused.
"The thieves gave me a good blow to the head," he said, "and my sight's been gone ever since, and my wife has a fever."
The man nodded.
"Of course, my,"
he stumbled over the language,
"my friends are not far. There is an oasis near here. We have a camp."
Cress swooned. "An oasis? A camp?"
"I must bring the animal,"
the man said, tilting his head toward the fallen creature.
"Can you walk? Maybe 10 minutes.
Thorne rubbed Cress's arms.
"We can walk."
The 10 minutes seemed like an hour to Cress as they followed the man through the desert, treading in the wake carved out by the animal's carcass. Cress tried not to look at the poor beast, keeping her thoughts instead on the promise of safety. When she spotted the oasis, like paradise before them, a sudden burst of joy clawed up and out of her throat. They'd made it.
"Describe," Thorne murmured, gripping her elbow.
"There's a lake," she said, knowing that this one was real, and not sure how she ever could have confused that vague mirage with something so stark and vibrant. "Blue as the sky, and surrounded by grasses and maybe a few dozen trees. Palm trees, I think. They're tall and skinny and..."
"The people, Cress. Describe the people."
"Oh," she counted. "I can see 7 people. I can't tell their genders from here. Everyone is wearing pale-colored robes over their heads, and there are, I think, camels tied up near the water. And there's a fire, and some people are setting out mats and tents. And there's so much shade."
The man with his kill stopped at the bottom of the slope.
"The man is waiting for us," Cress said.
Thorne bent near to her and placed a kiss against her cheek. Cress froze.
"Looks like we made it, Mrs. Smith."
As they got closer to the camp, the people stood. 2 members of the group walked out into the sand to greet them. Though they wore their cloaks over their heads, they'd pulled the covers down around their chins, and Cress could see that one of them was a woman. The hunter spoke to them in his other language, and a mixture of sympathy and curiosity entered the faces of these strangers, but not without a touch of suspicion. Though the woman's eyes were the sharpest of the group, she was the first to smile.
"What a trial you've been through," she said,
with an accent not quite as heavy as the hunter's. "My name is Gina, and this is my husband, Niels. Welcome to our caravan. Come. We have plenty of food and water. Niels, assist the man with his bag."
Her husband came forward to take the makeshift sack off Thorne's shoulder. Though it had become lighter as their water had disappeared, Thorne's face was one of relief to have the weight gone.
"We have some food in there," he said. "Preserved nutrition packs, mostly. It's not much, but it's yours, if you'll help us."
"Thank you for the offer," said Gina. "But this is not a negotiation, young man. We will help you."
Cress was grateful that no questions were asked as she and Thorne were led to the fire. The people shifted, eyeing them curiously as they made room on thickly woven mats. The hunter left them, dragging the animal's carcass to some other corner of the camp.
"What kind of animal was that?"
Cress asked, eyes stuck to the path left by its body.
"Desert addax," said Niels,
handing her and Thorn each a canteen full of water.
It was beautiful.
It will also be delicious. Now drink.
She wanted to mourn the animal, but the water was a blessed distraction. She dragged her attention to the canteen and did as she was told, drinking until her stomach ached from fullness. The people remained largely silent, and Cress felt the presence of their curiosity and stares closing in around her. She avoided meeting their eyes and unconsciously crept closer and closer against Thorn until he had no choice but to put an arm around her.
We're deeply grateful to you, he said, offering an easy smile to no one in particular. It was very lucky that you found us, or that Quende found you, said Gina. The desert is not a kind place. You must have a very lucky star.
Cressa's lips tugged into a smile.
You're very young.
The words sounded accusatory to Cressa's ears, but the woman's face was kind.
How long have you been married?
Newlyweds, said Thorn, giving Cressa a squeeze. This was supposed to be our honeymoon. So much for that lucky star, I guess.
And I'm not as young as I look, Cress added,
feeling like she had to offer something to the act. But her voice squeaked, and she quickly regretted speaking.
Gina winked. You'll be grateful for that youthfulness someday.
Cress lowered her gaze again, and was glad when a wide spoon and a bowl of steaming food was set before her, smelling exotic and spicy and rich. She hesitated and risked a sideways glance at the woman who had handed it to her, not sure if she was supposed to share or pass it to the next person or eat very slowly and delicately or... But within moments, everyone around the fire was enjoying their own food with relish. Flushing with hunger, Cress pulled the bowl onto her lap. She nibbled slowly at first, trying to identify the earthen foods. Peas she easily recognized. They had those on Luna, too. But there were some other sort of vegetables that she didn't know, mixed with rice and covered in a thick, aromatic sauce. She scooped out a chunk of something yellowish and firm. She bit into it and discovered it was tender and steaming on the inside.
Don't they have potatoes where you come from?
Cress jerked her head up and saw Gina watching her curiously. She gulped.
This sauce, she said quietly, hoping Gina wouldn't notice her evading the question. Potatoes, of course.
Luna's potatoes were a darker color with a flakier texture.
What is it?
Just a simple curry. Do you like it?
She nodded enthusiastically.
Very much, thank you.
Realizing that all eyes had turned to her again, she hastily shoveled the rest of the potato into her mouth, though the spices were making her cheeks flush. As she ate, a plate of dried meats was passed to her. She did not ask from what animal. And then a bowl filled with a juicy orange fruit and sweet, green-tinted nuts that were full of so many more flavors than the protein nuts Sybil had often brought for her.
Are you traders?
Thorn asked, accepting the handful of shelled nuts that Cress pressed into his palm.
We are, said Gina. We make this trek 4 times a year. I am upset by the threat of thieves. We haven't had such trouble in ages.
Desperate times, said Thorn with a shrug. If you don't mind my asking, why camels? It makes your way of life seem very second era.
Not at all. We make our living serving many of the smaller communities in the Sahara, many of which don't even have magnets on their own streets, much less on the trade routes between them.
Cress noticed Thorn's hand tightening around his bowl. The Sahara. So, her stargazing had been correct. But his expression remained impassive, and she forced hers to do the same.
Why not use wheeled vehicles, then?
We do, occasionally, said one of the men, for special circumstances. But the desert does harsh things to machinery. They're not as reliable as the camels.
Gina took a few slices of the sticky sweet fruit and added it to the top of her curry.
This may not be a luxurious life, but we stay busy. Our towns rely on us.
Cress listened attentively, but kept her attention on the food.
Now that they were safe, sheltered, and fed, she was developing a new fear, that at any moment, one of these men or women might look at her and see something different, something not quite earthen. Or that they would recognize Thorn, one of the most wanted fugitives on the planet. Whenever she dared to look up, she found their focus pinned on her and Thorn. She hunkered over her bowl of food, trying to fend off their prying eyes, and hoped that no one spoke to her. She became certain that any word she said would mark her as different, that simply by meeting their gazes, she would give herself away.
"Not many tourists come through here," said Gina's husband, Niels. "Any foreigners are usually just here for mining or archaeology. This side of the desert's been almost forgotten since the outbreak started."
"We heard the outbreaks aren't half as bad as rumored," said Thorn, lying with an ease that astonished Kress.
"You heard wrong. The plague outbreak is as bad as they think. Worse."
"Which town were you traveling to?" asked Gina.
"Oh, whichever one you're going to," Thorn said, not missing a beat. "We don't want to burden you. We'll take our leave in any town with a net screen. You wouldn't happen to have any port screens on hand, would you?"
"We do," said the oldest woman, perhaps in her 50s. "But net access is fickle here. We won't have a good connection until we get to Kufra."
"Kufra?"
"The next trading town," said Niels. "It will take us another day to get there, but you should be able to find whatever you need."
"We'll rest today and tonight and set out tomorrow," said Gina. "You need to replenish yourself, and we want to avoid the high sun."
Thorn flashed a most grateful smile. "We can't thank you enough." A bout of dizziness spun through Kress's head, forcing her to set down the bowl.
"You don't look well,"
someone said, she wasn't sure who.
"My wife was feeling ill earlier."
"You should have said. She could have heat sickness."
Gina stood, setting aside her food.
"Come, you should not be so near the fire. You can use Quende's tent tonight, but you should drink more before you sleep. Jamal, bring me some damp blankets."
Kress accepted the hand that pulled her to her feet. She turned to Thorn and gathered her courage to give him a small, non-theatrical kiss on the cheek. But as soon as she bent toward him, blood rushed to her head. The world flipped over. White spots pricked at her eyesight, and she collapsed into the sand.
Chapter 25. Cinder pulled back the drapes and stepped into the shop, holding the curtain for Jason as she surveyed the shelves around her. Jars were filled with assorted herbs and liquids, many of them labeled in a language she didn't know, although, if she stared at them for too long, her netlink would begin searching for a translation. These exotic ingredients were scattered among boxes of drugs and bottles of pills that she recognized from pharmacies in the Commonwealth, along with bundles of gauze and bandages, pasty ointments, port screen accessories designed for taking various vital stats, massage oils, candles, and anatomical models. Flecks of dust caught on a few streams of light that filtered in from dirty windows, and a fan spun lazily in the corner, doing little to dispel the dry heat. In the corner, a holograph displayed the progression of internal bleeding due to a side injury, occasionally flickering. Jason meandered toward the back of the shop, still walking with a slight limp.
"Hello?"
Cinder called. Another curtain hung over a doorway on the far wall, alongside an old mirror and a standing sink that was overgrown with a potted plant. The curtain swished, and a woman ducked through, pulling an apron over her plain jeans and a brightly patterned top.
"Coming, coming!"
She spotted Cinder. Her eyes widened, followed by an enormous smile as she yanked the apron strings behind her.
"Welcome!"
she said in the thick accent that Cinder was becoming familiar with.
"Hi, thank you,"
Cinder set a port screen down on the counter between them, pulling up the list that Dr. Erland had recorded for her.
"I'm here for some supplies. I was told you would have these things." Sindalin.
She raised her head. The woman was still beaming. Yes?
You are brave and beautiful.
She tensed, feeling more like the woman had threatened her than complimented her. In the moments following the unexpected statement, she waited for her lie detector to come on, but it never did. Brave, maybe. At least she could comprehend why someone would say that after they'd heard the stories about the ball. But beautiful? The woman kept smiling. Thank you? She nudged the port screen toward her. My friend gave me this list. The woman grabbed her hands and squeezed. Cinder gulped, surprised not only by the sudden touch, but at how the woman didn't flinch when she took her metal hand. Jason leaned over the counter and slid the port screen toward the woman so suddenly that she had to release Cinder's hand in order to catch it. We need these things, he said, pointing at the screen. The woman's smile vanished as her gaze swept over Jason, who was wearing the shirt from his guard uniform, freshly cleaned and patched so that the bloodstains hardly showed on the maroon fabric.
My son was also conscripted to become a guard for Lavanna.
Her eyes narrowed.
But he was not so rude.
Jason shrugged. Some of us have things to do. Wait, said Cinder. You're Lunar? Her expression softened when she focused on Cinder again.
Yes, like you.
She buried the discomfort that came with such an open admission. And your son is a royal guard?
No, he chose to kill himself rather than become one of her puppets.
She flashed a glare at Jason and stood a little taller.
Oh, I'm so sorry, said Cinder.
Jason rolled his eyes. I guess he must not have cared about you very much. Cinder gasped.
Jason!
Shaking his head, he snatched the port screen back from the woman. I'll start looking, he said, shouldering past Cinder. Why don't you ask her what happened next? Cinder glared at his back until he disappeared down one of the rows.
Sorry about that, she said, searching for some excuse. He's, you know, also Lunar.
He is one of hers.
Cinder turned back to the woman, who looked offended at Jason's words.
Not anymore.
Grunting, the woman turned to reposition the fan so Cinder could catch most of the gentle breeze.
Courage comes in many forms. You know about that.
Pride flickered over the woman's face.
I guess so.
Perhaps your friend was brave enough to join her guard. My son was brave enough not to.
Rubbing absently at her wrist, Cinder leaned against the counter.
Did something happen? Afterward?
Of course.
There was still pride on her face, but also anger, and also sadness.
3 days after my son died, 2 men came to our house. They took my husband out into the street and forced him to beg the queen's forgiveness for raising such a disloyal child. And then they killed him anyway as punishment, and as a warning to any other conscripts who were thinking of disobeying the crown.
Her eyes were beginning to water, but she held on to a pained smile.
It took me almost 4 years to find a ship that was coming to Earth and willing to accept me as a stowaway. 4 years of pretending that I didn't hate her, of pretending to be one more loyal citizen.
Cinder gulped. I'm so sorry.
Reaching forward, the woman cupped Cinder's cheek.
Thank you for defying her in a way that I never could.
Her voice turned to steel.
I hope you kill her.
Do you carry fentanyl 10? Asked Jason, returning to the counter and dropping 3 small boxes onto it. Pressing her lips, the woman took the port screen out of his hand.
I will do this,
she said, slipping around the counter and heading toward the front corner of the store. That's what I thought, he muttered. Cinder propped her chin on her metal fist, eyeing him. I never realized Royal Guard was a mandatory position. Not for everyone. A lot of people want to be chosen. It's a big honor on Luna. Did you? He slid his gaze to her. Nah, I always wanted to be a doctor. His tone was thick with sarcasm, and yet Cinder's optobionics didn't peg it as a lie. She crossed her arms.
So, who were you protecting?
What do you mean?
Something scraped against the floor, the shopkeeper shoving around dusty bins. When you were conscripted to be a royal guard, who would Lavanna have murdered if you'd refused? His pale eyes frosted over. Reaching past the counter, he angled the fan toward himself.
Doesn't matter. They're probably going to end up dead anyway.
Cinder looked away. Because he'd chosen to join her side, his loved ones could suffer. Maybe not, she said. Lavanna doesn't know that you betrayed her yet. She could think I glamored you, that I'm forcing you to help us.
And you think that will make a difference?
It might, she watched as the shopkeeper dug through a bin. A fly buzzed near her head, and Cinder batted it away.
So, how does one get chosen to be a royal guard anyway?
There are certain traits they look for.
And loyalty isn't one of them?
Why would it be? She can fake loyalty. It's like with your special op friend. He would have shown fast reflexes, good instincts, and some amount of common sense. Match him up with a thaumaturge who can turn him into a wild animal, and it no longer matters what he thinks or wants. He just does what he's told.
I've seen Wolf fight it, Cinder said, feeling compelled to defend him now that Scarlet wasn't here to do it.
The first time Cinder had seen Wolf, he'd been covered in blood and crouched threateningly over Scarlet, although Scarlet had always insisted that he wouldn't have hurt her, that he was different from the others, stronger. Of course, that was before Wolf had gotten himself shot, taking a bullet for a thaumaturge, moments before Scarlet was kidnapped. It's obviously not easy to do, she amended, but it is possible for them to fight against the mind control.
Lots of good that seems to have done him.
Locking her jaw, Cinder pressed her metal hand against the back of her neck, letting it cool her down.
He'd rather fight and lose than become another one of her pawns. We all would.
Good for you. Not everyone's given that option.
She noticed that his hand had settled comfortably on the knife sheathed against his thigh.
Clearly, Lavanna didn't want you for your chattiness. So what were the traits you possessed that made her think you'd be a good guard?
That look of smug amusement returned, like he was letting her in on a private joke.
My pretty face, he said. Can't you tell?
She snorted.
You're starting to sound like Thorn.
She stumbled over his name. Thorn, who would never make jokes about his own charisma again. Jason didn't seem to notice.
It's sad, but true.
Cinder swallowed her sudden remorse.
Lavanna chooses her personal guards based on who makes the best wall decorations?
I'm suddenly feeling better about our chances.
That and our very weak minds.
You're kidding.
Nope.
If I'd been good with my gift, I might have made thaumaturge, but the queen wants her guards to be easily controlled. We're like puppets for her to shuffle around. After all, if we show the slightest resistance to being controlled, it could mean the difference between life and death for Her Majesty.
Cinder thought of the ball, when she'd had the gun and had tried to shoot Lavanna. The red-haired guard had jumped in front of the bullet without hesitation. She'd always assumed he'd been doing his duty to protect the queen, that he'd done it willingly. But now, she recognized how his movements were too jerky, too unnatural, and how the queen hadn't even flinched. She'd been controlling him. Jason was right. He'd acted just like a puppet.
But you were able to resist control on the ship.
Because Thaumaturge Mira was preoccupied with your operative. Otherwise, I would have been the same brainless mannequin that I usually am.
His tone was self-deprecating, but Cinder could detect bitterness beneath it. Nobody liked to be controlled, and she didn't think anyone ever got used to it.
And you don't think they suspected that you're
a traitor?
If that's what you are.
His thumb traced around the knife handle.
My gift is pretty much worthless. I couldn't even control an earthen, much less a skilled lunar. I could never do what you do. But I've gotten pretty good at keeping my thoughts empty when the Queen or Thaumaturge is around. To them, I have about as much brains and willpower as a tree stump. Not exactly threatening. Near the front of the store, the woman started humming to herself as she scavenged for Cinder's supplies. You're doing it right now, aren't you? Said Cinder, crossing her arms. Keeping your thoughts empty?
It's a habit.
Closing her eyes, Cinder felt around for him with her thoughts. His presence was there, but just barely. She knew that she could have controlled him without any effort at all, but the energy rolling off his body didn't give anything away. No emotions, no opinions. He simply melted into the background.
Huh.
I always thought your training must have taught you that.
Just healthy self-preservation.
Furrowing her brow, she opened her eyes again. The man before her was an emotional black hole, according to her lunar gift. But if he could fool Levana... She narrowed her eyes. Lie to me.
What?
Tell me a lie. It doesn't have to be a big one. He was silent for a long time, and she imagined she could hear him sifting through all the lies and truths, weighing them against each other. Finally, he said,
Levana's not so bad once you get to know her.
An orange light blinked on in the corner of her vision. At Jason's mocking grin, Cinder started to laugh, the tension rising off her shoulders like heat waves off the desert sand. At least her cyborg programming could still tell her whether or not he was lying to her, which meant he hadn't been lying when he'd said he was loyal to his princess, and his princess alone. The shopkeeper returned and dumped an armful of different drugs on the counter, scanned the port screen, whistled, then drifted away again.
Now that you know all about me, said Jason, as if it were anywhere close to true, I have a question for you.
Go for it, she said, organizing the bottles into neat rows. My secrets are mostly public knowledge these days.
I may be able to hide my emotions from the Queen, but I can't hide the fact that I'm lunar, and that I can be controlled by her.
But when you first came to that ball, your gift seemed non-existent.
Honestly, I thought you were earthen at first, and I know that's why the Queen and Thaumaturge Mira were taunting you, treating you like a shell, which you might as well have been for how powerless you were.
He stared at Cinder, as if trying to see into the mess of wires and chips in her head.
Then, suddenly, you weren't powerless anymore. Your gift was practically blinding, maybe even worse than Levana's.
Gee, thanks, Cinder muttered.
So, how did you do it? How could you hide that much power? Levana should have known immediately. We all should have known. Now when I look at you, it's practically all I see.
Biting her lip, Cinder glanced toward the mirror over the shop's small sink. She caught her reflection and wasn't surprised to find a smudge of dirt on her jaw. How long had it been there? And strands of hair falling messily out of her ponytail. True to form, the mirror showed her just as she had always been. Plain, dirty, a cyborg. She tried to imagine what it would be like to see herself as she saw Levana. Frighteningly gorgeous and powerful. But it was impossible with that reflection staring back at her. That was why Levana despised mirrors so much. But Cinder found her reflection almost comforting. The shopkeeper called her brave and beautiful. Jason called her blinding. It was kind of nice to know that they were both wrong. She was still just Cinder. Tucking a strand of hair behind her ear, she tried her best to explain to Jason the bioelectrical security system her adoptive father had invented and installed on her spinal cord. For years, it had prevented her from using her gift, which was why, until recently, she hadn't known she was lunar at all. The device was meant to protect her, not only by preventing her from using her gift so that Earthens wouldn't know what she was, but also to prevent the side effects that most lunars experienced when they didn't use their gift for long periods of time. Side effects of delusions and depressions and madness. That's why you might overhear Dr. Erland babbling to himself sometimes, she said.
He didn't use the gift for years after coming to Earth, and now his sanity is...
Wait.
She paused, not only because Jason had spoken, but because something had changed in the air around him. A sudden spike of emotion, catching Cinder off guard.
This device kept you from losing your mental stability, even though you weren't using your gift for years.
Well, it kept me from using my gift in the first place, and also protected me from those side effects. He turned his face away from her and took a minute to school his features back into nonchalance, but it was too late. There was a new intensity behind his eyes as he grasped the implications. A device that could take away a person's lunar gift would make them all equal.
Anyway, said Cinder, rubbing the back of her neck where the device was still installed, though now broken. Dr. Erlan disabled it. My gift had been coming and going for a couple of weeks before the ball, but then all the emotional stress overwhelmed my system and the device, and there I was, fully lunar. Not a moment too soon. She cringed, recalling the sensation of a gun pressed against her temple.
Do any more of these devices exist? He said, his eyes strangely bright.
I don't think so. My stepfather died before it was fully tested, and as far as I know, he didn't manufacture any others. Although he may have left behind some plans or blueprints that explain how it works.
Doesn't seem possible. An invention like that, it could change everything.
He shook his head, staring into space as the shopkeeper returned and set a basket full of supplies on the counter. She grabbed the bottles from before and threw them on top, along with Cinder's port screen.
This is perfect, said Cinder, pulling the basket toward her. Thank you so much. The doctor said you could put it on his tab?
No payment from Cinder Lynn, said the woman, waving one hand while she pulled a port screen out of her apron pocket.
But may I take your picture for my net profile, my first celebrity?
Cinder flinched away from her.
I'm sorry, I'm not really doing the picture thing these days.
The woman wilted in disappointment, tucking her port back into her pocket.
Sorry, really. I'll talk to the doctor about paying you, all right?
She hauled the basket off the counter without waiting to hear another argument.
Not doing pictures these days? Jason muttered as they hurried through the shop. How very lunar of you.
Cinder glared against the sudden burning sunlight.
Very wanted criminal of me, too.
Chapter 26. Although Scarlett's thoughts were as thick as mud, her fingers were nimble and fast, dancing through the familiar motions of powering down the pod ship. Just like all those nights she returned to the farm after finishing her deliveries, she could almost smell the musty tang of her grandmother's hangar, combined with the fresh, earthy breeze coming off the fields. She lowered the landing gear and eased down the brakes. The ship settled, humming idly for a moment before she shut down the engine and it fell silent. Something thumped behind her. A woman began to yell shrilly, her anger made sticky and confusing in Scarlett's cobwebbed brain. A headache began to throb in the front of her skull, gradually taking over her entire head. Scarlett flinched and leaned back in the pilot's seat, pressing her palms over her eyes to block out the pain, the swamp of confusion, the sudden piercing light that burst through her vision. She groaned, slumping forward. No harness caught her like she'd expected, and soon she was hunched over her knees, taking full, gasping breaths as if she'd nearly drowned. Her mouth was dry, her jaw aching, as if she'd been grinding her teeth for hours. But as she held very still and choked on very deep breaths, the throbbing in her head began to subside. Her thoughts cleared, the muffled yelling sharpened and spiked. Scarlett opened her eyes. A surge of nausea passed over her, but she swallowed hard and let it pass. She knew instantly that this was not her delivery ship, and she was not in her grandmother's hangar. The smell was all wrong, the floorboards too clean.
want Lieutenant Hensler sent down immediately, along with a full team for scouting and ship identification.
The woman's voice shot like electricity through Scarlett's nerves, and she remembered. The ship, the attack, the gun in her hand, the bullet hitting Wolf in the chest, the sense of hollowness as the thaumaturge burrowed into her brain, took over her thoughts, took away all sense of identity and will.
Use the shuttle's history to track the last location and see if it has any lingering connectivity to the main ship. They may have gone to Earth. Figure it out. Find her.
Scarlett raised her head enough that she could peer out of the pod ship's side window. Luna. She was on Luna, docked in an enclosed space that was nothing at all like the hangar she had known or the podship dock of the Rampian. It was large enough to house a dozen shuttles, and a few were already lined up alongside hers, their sleek shapes ornamented with the royal lunar insignia. The walls were jagged and black, but speckled with small, glowing lights to mimic a non-existent sky. A faint light was glowing up from the ground, so that the shadows of the pod ships stretched like birds of prey along the cavernous walls. At the end of the row of ships was an enormous arched doorway, embedded with glittering stones that depicted a crescent moon rising above planet Earth.
Took this DCOM from the programmer who betrayed us. See if the software techs can use it to trace the companion chip.
The pod ship door behind her was still open, and the thaumaturge was standing just outside the ship, yelling at the people who had gathered around her. Two guards in red and gray uniforms and a middle-aged man who wore a simple belted robe and was hastily plugging information into a port screen. The thaumaturge's long white coat was smeared with blood and soaked through where it draped over her thigh. She stood slightly hunched, her hands pressed over the wound. The arch door began to open, cutting a slit through the center of the glittering earth as the doors peeled back. Scarlett ducked back down. She heard the subtle click and hum of magnets, the clatter of footsteps.
Finally, the thaumaturge seethed. The uniform is ruined. Cut away the material and be quick. The bullet didn't pass through, and the wound hasn't... She cut off with a hiss.
Daring to glance up, Scarlett saw that three new people had arrived, dressed in white lab coats. They brought a hovering gurney with them, stocked with a full lab's worth of medical supplies, and were all crowded around the thaumaturge, one unbuttoning her coat while another tried to cut a square of fabric away from her pants, though the material seemed to have cemented itself to the wound. The thaumaturge recovered and rearranged her features to disguise how much pain she was in, though her olive skin had taken on a yellowish pallor. One of the doctors managed to peel the material away from the wound.
Have Sierra send for a new uniform, and contact Thaumaturge Park to inform him that there will soon be changes to our procedures for gathering intelligence in relation to the Earthen leaders.
Yes, Thaumaturge Mira, said the middle-aged man. Speaking of Park, you should know that he already had a meeting with Emperor Kaito regarding our fleet of operatives that appears to no longer be in disguise.
She cursed. I forgot about the ships. I hope he was smart enough not to tell them anything before we've established an official statement.
She paused to take in a warbling breath.
Also, inform Her Majesty of my return.
Scarlett slid down in the seat. Her eyes darted to the door on the other side of the pod ship. She considered starting the engine, but she had no chance of escaping in the Rampian's shuttle. They had to be underground, and the port's exit probably required special authorization to open. But if she could reach one of those other ships... Trying to take calming breaths, she inched herself over the central console, into the co-pilot's seat. She braced herself, her heart pummeling against her collarbone. She counted down from three in her head before unlatching the door, prying it open at glacial speeds so the movement wouldn't be noticed by the lunars behind her. Slipping out and settling her sneakers onto the floor. Now she could tell where the peculiar light was coming from. The entire floor was set in glowing white tiles, making it feel as if she were walking on, well, the moon. She paused to listen. The doctors were discussing entrance wounds. The assistant was listing times for a meeting with the queen. For once, the thaumaturge had gone silent.
Breathe. Breathe.
Scarlet stepped away from the podship. Her hair was clinging to her damp neck, and she was trembling with fear and building adrenaline and the encroaching knowledge of how this would never work. She wouldn't be able to get into the lunar ship. They would shoot her in the back at any moment. Or she would get in the ship but not know how to fly it. Or the port's exit wouldn't open. But the lunars were still carrying on behind her, and she was so close. And this could work. This had to work. Crouching against the lunar ship's shimmering white body, she licked her lips and inched her fingers toward the door panel. Her hand froze. Her heart plummeted. The air around her fell silent, charged with an energy that made every hair stand up on Scarlet's arm. Her mind stayed sharp this time, fully aware of how close she had come to getting inside that ship and making a mad dash for her safety, and at the same time, fully aware that she'd never had a chance. With a snap, her hand unfroze and she dropped it to her side. Scarlet forced her chin up and, using the side of the podship for balance, she stood and turned to face the thaumaturge. Sitting on the hovering gurney, Sybil Mira had been stripped down to a light undershirt and was leaning to one side so the doctors could have access to the bullet wound. There was blood speckled on her cheek and brow, and her hair was tangled and clumped haphazardly with yet more blood. But still, she managed to look intimidating as her gray eyes held Scarlet pinned against the ship. The doctors were hunkered over her thigh, working intently, as if they were afraid she would notice they were there as they cleaned and inspected and stitched. The two guards had their guns in hand, though their stances were relaxed as they awaited orders. The assistant, who had been middle-aged and plain in every way before, had changed. Though he still wore the belted robe, he himself had become unearthly handsome. Early 20s, strong-jawed, with pitch-black hair slicked neatly back from a widow's peak on his brow. Scarlet clenched her jaw and forced her brain to remember what he looked like before, not to give any weight to his imposed glamour. It was only a small rebellion, but she embraced it with all the mental strength she had left. "This must be the hostage taken from the cyborg's ship," the assistant said. "What shall I have done with her?" The thaumaturge's gaze narrowed on Scarlet, with a hatred that could have melted skin off bones. The feeling was mutual. Scarlet glared right back.
"I need time to brief Her Majesty about her," said Sybil. "I suspect she will want to be present when the girl is questioned."
She twitched as pain flickered across her face. Scarlet could see the moment when the thaumaturge lost interest in Scarlet's fate, when her shoulders slumped as she drew on whatever energy she had left to lower herself fully onto the gurney.
"I don't care what you do with her in the meantime. Give her to one of the families if you want."
The assistant nodded and gestured to the guards. Within seconds, they had stepped forward and pulled Scarlet away from the podship, locking her hands behind her with some sort of binding that dug into her forearms. By the time they began marching her toward the enormous arched doors, the doctors and the thaumaturge were already gone.
Chapter 27. Time passed in a haze. Dreams and reality blurring together. Being pulled from her sleep, forced to sit up and drink some water. Snips of muddled conversations. Shivering. Hot and sweating and kicking off the thin blankets. Thorn beside her, tying a blindfold around his head. Hands holding the water bottle to her lips. Drink. 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 Eat the soup, drink some more. Unfamiliar laughter making her curl up into a ball and burrow beneath the blankets. Thorn's silhouette in the moonlight, rubbing his eyes and cursing. Gasping for breath in the hot air, sure that she was going to suffocate beneath the blankets and that all the oxygen would be sucked up into the dark night sky.
desperate for water.
Itchy from the sand still in her clothes and hair. Light. Darkness. Light again. Finally, Cress awoke, groggy but lucid. Saliva was thick and sticky in her mouth, and she was lying on a mat inside a small tent, alone. It was dark beyond the thin fabric walls, and the moonlight spilled over the pile of clothing at her feet. She felt for her hair, meaning to strangle her wrists with it, but found it chopped beneath her ears. The memories returned, lazy at first. Thorn in the satellite, Sybil and her guard, the fall and the knife and the cruel desert stretching to the ends of the earth. She could hear voices outside. She wondered whether the night had just begun or was already ending. She wondered how long she'd slept. She seemed to recall arms around her, soft knuckles brushing sand off her face. Had it been a dream? The tent's flap opened, and a woman appeared with a tray. The older woman from the fire. She beamed and set down the food, some sort of soup and a canteen of water. "Finally," she said in that thick, unfamiliar accent, crawling over the mounds of disheveled blankets. "How do you feel?" She pressed a palm to Cress's forehead. "Better, good." "How long was I?"
2 days. We're behind schedule now, but no matter. It's good to see you awake."
She sat down beside Cress. It was a snug fit in the tent, but not uncomfortable.
"You will have a camel to ride when we leave. We need to keep your wounds clean. You were lucky we got you before the infection."
"Wounds?" The woman gestured to her feet, and Cress bent over. It was too dark to see, but she could feel bandages. Even 2 days later, they were sore to the touch, and her leg muscles tingled from exertion.
"Where's—"
She hesitated, unable to remember if Thorn had given himself a fake name.
"My husband."
"He's been entertaining us with talk of your whirlwind romance, lucky girl."
She gave a sly wink that made Cress withdraw, then patted Cress's knee. She handed the bowl of soup to her.
"Eat first. If you're strong enough, you can come join us."
She scooted back toward the entrance.
"Wait, I have to—"
She blushed, and the woman gave her an understanding look.
"I'm sure you do. Come along. I'll show you where to do your business."
There was a pair of boots by the tent's opening that were far too big for her. The woman helped Cress stuff them with cloth until they bordered uncomfortable, though the bottoms of her feet still stung. And then she led her away from the fire, to a hole they'd dug into the sand at the edge of the oasis. Two sheets had been hung up for privacy, and there was a young palm tree to balance on while Cress relieved herself. When she was alone, the woman guided her back to the tent, and then left her alone to savor the soup. Her appetite had returned tenfold since her first meal in the oasis. Her gut felt hollow, but the broth soothed her as she listened to the chatter of strangers. She tried to pick out Thorn's voice, but couldn't. When Cress crawled out of the tent again, she saw eight forms seated around the fire. Gina was stirring a pot half buried in the sand, and Thorn sat relaxed and cross-legged on one of the mats. He had a bandana around his eyes.
"She rises,"
yelled the hunter, Quende. Thorn raised his head, and his surprise broke into a toothy grin.
"My wife?"
he said, louder than necessary. Cress's nerves crawled to find so many strangers staring at her. Her breathing became erratic, and she considered feigning a dizzy spell to seek solace back in the tent. But then, Thorn was standing, or trying to, wobbling on one knee like he might tip right over into the fire.
"Uh-oh,"
Cress darted to his side. With her help, he heaved himself up to his feet and grasped her hands, still shaky.
"Cress?"
"Yes, Cap.
You're awake, finally."
How do you feel? He sought out her forehead, his palm landing first on her nose before sliding up to her forehead.
Oh, good. Your fever's gone down. I was so worried.
He pulled her into an embrace, dwarfing her in his arms. Kress squeaked, but the sound was muffled in the cotton of his shirt. He released her just as quickly and cupped her face in both hands.
My dear Mrs. Smith, never scare me like that again.
Although his act was overdone, Kress felt a jolt behind her sternum at seeing his mouth set just so, feeling his hands so tender against her cheeks.
I'm sorry, she whispered. I feel much better now.
You look much better. His lips quirked. At least, I'm assuming you do. Thorn dug his toes into the sand and flicked up one end of a long stick, catching it easily.
Come on, let's go for a walk. Try to get some real alone time on this honeymoon of ours.
He twisted his face into a wink that was obvious even beneath the blindfold. The crowd around the fire hollered as Thorn took Kress's hand. She guided him away from the taunts, glad that the night's darkness hid her burning cheeks.
You seem to be getting around well, she said when they'd gone some distance from the fire, though she was glad when Thorn didn't release her hand.
I've been practicing walking with a new cane. One of the guys made it for me, and it's a lot nicer than that metal one. The camp setup still confuses me, though. I swear they keep moving stuff around every time I think I've got it figured out.
I should have been there to help you, she said as they neared the small lake. I'm sorry I slept so long.
He shrugged.
I'm just glad you're all right. I really was worried.
Her attention caught on their entwined fingers like a beacon. Every twitch, every heartbeat, every step was broadcast through her entire body. It wasn't long before her imagination had them lying together in the warm sand, his fingers stroking through her hair, his lips working their way along her jaw.
So, listen, Thorn said, snapping her away from the dream. I told everyone that once we get to town, we're going to call up my uncle in America and have him send transportation, so we won't be continuing on with them.
Kress tucked her hair behind her ears, still shaking off the tendrils of the fantasy. The touch of night air on her neck was unexpectedly pleasant.
And you think we'll be able to contact your crew?
That's my hope. I mean, the ship doesn't have any tracking equipment, but given that you were able to find our location before, I thought maybe you could think of some way to at least get a message to them.
They made a full circle around the camels, who eyed them with blatant disinterest, while Kress's brain started rummaging through a dozen possible means of communicating with an untraceable ship, and what she would need to accomplish it. She hadn't been able to do it from the satellite, but with the right net access. She was grateful when they arrived at their little tent. Though the walk had been short, the large boots had already begun to burn. She sank down on the mat and pulled one off, inspecting the bandages as well as she could in the dark. Thorn settled down beside her.
Everything all right?
I hope we can find some shoes when we get to this town, she sighed dreamily. My first pair of real shoes, he smirked.
Now you're sounding like a true earthen lady. She glanced toward the fire to make sure no one overheard them.
Can I ask why you're wearing a blindfold?
His finger skimmed the material.
I think it was making people uncomfortable. My staring into space all the time, or looking right through them.
She dipped her head, pulling off the second boot.
It didn't make me uncomfortable. I think your eyes are,
well, dreamy. His lips quirked.
So, you have noticed.
Pulling off the bandana, he tucked it into a pocket before stretching his legs out in front of him. Kress fidgeted with the blunt ends of her hair, staring at his profile with a longing that made her entire body ache. Finally, after an agonizing minute of gathering her courage, she shifted closer to him and leaned her head against his shoulder.
Good idea, he said, wrapping an arm around her waist.
How could they not think that we're in love?
How couldn't they? She murmured. She squeezed her eyes shut and tried to memorize the exact feel.